You're listening to the RBN Republic Broadcasting Network at republicbroadcasting.org. Today is Saturday, March the 9th, 2024. Oh, man, time's flying. And this is hour one of Thought Crime Live. My name is Stephen Whitener, Stephen Douglas Whitener. I'm your host, and y'all are thought criminals just for listening to me, and also thought criminals for listening to RBN in general. And RBN, guys, it means quite a bit to me, so y'all help keep RBN on the air if you can. I don't know where else you could find the content and the open discussions that we have here. I mean, people, this really is a unique place. Mr. Stadmiller called it the canary in the coal mine of free speech. And I just, we are listener supported. So if you want to help out and can, if I know times are tough, but if you can help out at all, it really helps, especially if you can do it monthly, and they know that they'll be coming in every month. You can donate by credit, debit card. You just call 800-724-2719, extension 3. That's 800-724-2719, extension 3, and they'll take your donation there. You can use PayPal on the RBN website. You just smash that button that says donation on PayPal. It's a big yellow button. If you want to be a real thought criminal like myself, you could just mail some cash or a check or money order made out to RBN to 2251 Double Creek Drive, Suite 302, Round Rock, Texas. I'll say that again, 2251 Double Creek Drive, Suite 302, Round Rock, Texas. Hey, and we definitely appreciate it, folks. And this morning, I have a terrific guest joining me. This gentleman taught the class that I attend Tuesdays over on, in Telegram, Mike Gaddy's Teach Me True History class, and it was such a good presentation. I knew you guys would appreciate it. And Mr. Richard Hamblin, sir, thanks very much for joining me, committing a little thought crime this morning. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine. Thank you for allowing me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about what we're going to talk about.
Yes, sir. And you, I'll turn it over to you. I did not get the details of exactly what the charge that was against you that you've been appealing, and I'll let you just start and introduce yourself, because I heard the presentation, but that's the part I missed at the very beginning. Yes, sir.
Okay, my name is Richard Hamblin. I'm a lifelong Tennessean. I'm 69 now. My backgrounds: I grew up in Nashville, went to Vanderbilt University, got a degree in classical languages, went into the U.S. Army, part of ROTC, and then subsequently was in the National Guard, the Reserves, and the Tennessee State Guard. I own a glass business. We install mirrors and shower doors. I've been doing that since 1987. I had an adventure with the Second Amendment. I'm not really a technical expert, you know, a certified expert on it. I've just lived through it, and I can done a lot of research in conjunction with what happened to me. And it's although it's been 20 years ago, it's almost 20 years ago. I welcome this opportunity to kind of elucidate to people on your audience and anybody else who wants to hear about it, on what I perceive is to be the reality of the situation based on my experiences. And there again, these are my opinions, and my opinions are obviously wrong because I didn't prevail in court and ended up going to prison.
Well, that's not that, sir, these days, that, you know how corrupt it is anyway, but yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, I kind of like wear that as a badge of honor. It really was kind of a, I don't know, I guess the pivotal point in my life. My life before it is completely different from my life after it. So in a good way. So a lot of things happened. And it resolved, basically resolved any doubts or any misconceptions I had about the nature of the system and the United States government and the Constitution and the judicial system and just any number of things. It's just kind of brought it all into focus. Ironically, I never felt so, at least psychologically free as when I was locked up in the BOP. So that's, you know, there were no illusions there. Although a lot of guys did lie about their cases, but not me. Anyway, what happened was I've always considered myself a patriot. I always considered myself a constitutionalist. until I really got digging into the nuts and bolts of the Constitution and the history behind it. And Michael Gaddy's program has been very helpful in clarifying the nature of the system in which we live. And even though I've only been, you know, listening to him intensely for the last year, so I pretty much agree with, you know, his analysis on how things have turned and how they were intended to be realistically when you get down to it. My situation was that I was in the Tennessee State Guard, which is not part of the National Guard, only because we're headquartered under it, but it's not actually part of the National Guard or the United States Army, nor do we benefit from any, you know, monetarily or equipment or whatever from the United States government. In fact, I think it's probably a provision in law that prevents it. But anyway, I know we never were allowed to draw equipment or uniforms or anything from them. So I was in the 201st Military Police Battalion, which is centered in Middle Tennessee as part of the 2nd Brigade. And the Tennessee State Guard was set up as a cadre-type unit. In other words, it was rank-heavy, and when the need occurred, it was to be filled out, presumably by a draft, by the governor. The State Guard was set up as to be, by state law, I mean, you can see this on the books, to be a backup armed force, emphasis on armed force, for in any time in which any or all of the state of the National Guard is called up for service in the United States. And, you know, and that's happened a lot since World War II. And the period I'm talking about is immediately preceding the year 2000 up to about 2005. I was in the Guard. We were tasked with various things. And, of course, during that period, the Iraq War was going on. The Afghanistan War was going on. And the Guard had been called up out of the state to go elsewhere. So, you know, there was legal basis for the Guard to become armed. The problem is the State Guard at that time only had 21 rifles assigned to the approximately 2,600 person, let's get it right. We did have women in there. 2,600 person force, and it was of course the State Guard was scattered from, you know, Bristol all the way to Memphis. So I mean, and the weapons were concentrated in an armory at Smyrna, in a National Guard armory at Smyrna. And they were 21 obsolete, quote unquote obsolete, M16A1 rifles. They were the type that had the selector switch disabled, and they put a tab in between the pistol grip and the lower receiver so that you couldn't turn the selector all the way to full auto. But otherwise, I mean, they were full auto in effect. If you had one of those as a civilian, the ATF would bust you and, you know, put you in, successfully prosecute you actually as having a machine gun, even though it only fired semi-automatically. So, there was a lot of noise going on at the time, and, you know, and I've figured out that we may be called up to actually do something, especially in wake of the big smallpox scare. I guess you remember that back in about 2002 or thereabouts, you know, when Saddam was going to throw, you know, send some missiles and create an epidemic here in the United States. And to counter that, I guess you could look at it as sort of a dry run for what they successfully pulled off with COVID, but they were going to do mass inoculations of the population. And there were some model health care protection acts that were circulating throughout the United States that were adopted by the various state legislatures. The main one was proposed by Johns Hopkins University, and Tennessee adopted a modified version of it, but a lot of other states did too. Let me back up a little bit. There are, at the time I was in, there are 26 state guards in existence throughout the country. Texas had, at that time, a pretty big one. I understand Florida right now has beefed theirs up and is actually arming it. But at that time, we had no arms. We were created under 26 U.S. Code, which is puts into codified law the provision in the Constitution that prohibits states from keeping troops in peacetime unless authorized by Congress. So this was supposed to be the congressional authorization for the existence of the Guard. So anyway, like I say, I was a constitutionalist. I had read a lot of stuff on the Second Amendment and the right to keep and bear arms starting back in the 90s, because I got really incensed at the Rodney King riots in L.A. It was, you know, just all the absurd circumstances around that where, you know, the California Guard was deployed, but they weren't given any ammunition. You know, you remember the stories of the rooftop Koreans who were protecting their businesses.
Yes.
From the rioters.
I remember that, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And all that kind of stuff. So that kind of got me up. And then, of course, Bill Clinton comes along with the assault weapons ban. And things just, you know, things were coming to a head at that time. You had Oklahoma City, you had Waco, you had Oklahoma City, you had the Randy Weaver standoff. You know, the Montana Freeman and all that kind of stuff. So there was a big undercurrent of dissatisfaction, I guess, with the way things were going. And so at that time, if you'll recall, toward the end of the 20th century, if you follow gun sites like, not sites, but newspapers, actually, the physical newspaper like Shotgun News, and looked on the websites of places like Starco and so on, there was just a tremendous amount of military surplus gear coming out of Eastern Europe with the fall of the Soviet Union, to include demilitarized machine guns like MG-42s, which I had one, actually, but put me in jail, and 1919 A4s, which came out of Israel, ironically, which were, you know, originally purchased by the United States military, given to Israel, and of course the Israelis demilitarize them by taking off a side, you know, a critical part on them, and sell them back to the United States. At one point, these kits were as cheap as like $300, I think, for a parts kit, what they call them, and it didn't really take a whole lot of technical expertise to get an 80% side plate and put them back together and make them functional. Same thing with an MG-42. They cut the jackets on them, and which could be welded back together. All the internal parts were useful and, you know, good operating condition and so on. So anyway, what I did was I took some of these weapons, I reassembled them for use by my State Guard unit, and we trained with them a couple of times in a state hunting preserve. And then that kind of got things rolling there, where I got a visit from them one day, and they, you know, it ended up me going to court, and I was charged with violating the National Firearms Act of 1934 for having unregistered weapons without paying a tax on them, and also violating the 1986 Omnibus Crime Bill, which I think was called the Vollmer Act. But anyway, it closed off the register for new additions of new National Firearms Act weapons, as far as machine guns are concerned. Anything else like sawed-off shotguns or that kind of stuff, you could apply for the license, you know, pay the tax, and you could, you know, go along your merry way and have a registered sawed-off shotgun. So, you know, most of this stuff is not illegal in and of itself. And it's still not illegal for citizens to own machine guns. You just have to pay for it. And because of the results of the 1986 Act, the prices of these things went up dramatically, as you can imagine. But anyway, so I got these kits, which were relatively cheap, and I remanufactured them for use by our unit, and then they drug me into court. As always, the FBI tried to make me turn informant and, you know, do crap like that for them. And, but I took it to trial anyway, and ended up getting two sentences that ran concurrently of 15 months each, and then which I served, and I had an additional 24 months of probation on top of that. Actually, I got off pretty light as far as these things go. when I got into the camp where I was sentenced, everybody talks about their case and such, and whether or not their lawyer's any good and how much money they spend on blah, 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 and all that. But looking around, I got off kind of light. In fact, even at the sentencing, my judge called me a misguided patriot. And he said, it's rare when we get some like you up here, Mr. Hamlin. I don't even see a traffic ticket in your record. So I think that kind of surprised him. And he went kind of light on the sentence. I mean, it's enough. I mean, believe me, anything more than about 60 days in jail will wreck your life. But I was fortunate, that my brother kind of kept things going for me until I got out. So I was able to resume my business once I was relieved. So then we started the appeal process. This started, the appeals were occurring about 2006, I guess, 6 and 7. My appeal of my sentence went up to the Supreme Court, of course, went to the appeals court, then went to the Supreme Court within 5 days of Dick Heller filing his petition for writ of certiorari with the Supreme Court. As you recall, the Heller case involved District of Columbia denying him a handgun permit, which supposedly was a basis for his having standing. And the question that was proposed in his case, can the District of Columbia ban handguns while at the same time allowing rifles and shotguns? Okay. The caption on my case was, can a member of a statutorily created state militia keep and bear arms of the type in common use by the military today? So you compare those two questions, and which one do you think the Supreme Court's going to take?
The handgun one, maybe?
Yeah, they're going to take Heller. If it took mine, it would overturn, number one, it would overturn the NFA, which is the basis for all of gun control that's in existence.
It's the first break, folks. First break coming up, y'all. Stay with us.
All right.
Be right back.
Publicly admits that income tax is collected by voluntary compliance. Get the information you need to help you avoid income tax with these 5 easy steps. All you have to do is go to avoidincometax.com to get your 5 easy steps on how to avoid the IRS income tax. Escape the IRS. Let avoidincometax.com help you. We guarantee our 5 easy steps or your money back. Go to avoidincometax.com.
Attention, freedom-loving patriots. Are you ready to dive deep into the principles that founded our great nation? Join me, Peter Serafin, and the Institute on the Constitution as we light the way to a brighter future with the Liberty Lighthouse Classroom. At liberty-lighthouse.com/classroom, you'll find a treasure trove of online courses on the U.S. Constitution, carefully crafted to empower you with knowledge to defend your rights and liberty. Whether you're a student, a history enthusiast, or just a concerned citizen, these courses are for you. Gain a comprehensive understanding of our Constitution's principles, the wisdom of our founding fathers, and how to apply them in today's world. as a special offer to our freedom-loving listeners of Republic Broadcasting Network, use coupon code RBN at checkout and get 20% discount on any course. Join the Liberty Lighthouse Classroom and be a part of the movement to uphold the values that have made our nation exceptional. Unleash the power of knowledge and protect what truly matters, our Constitution. Visit liberty-lighthouse.com/classroom today. Don't miss this incredible opportunity. Use code RBN for 20% off. Together, we'll be the beacon of freedom our founding generation envisioned. Liberty Lighthouse Classroom, illuminating minds, empowering patriots.
Welcome back, Thought Criminals. You're listening to RBN. This is Thought Crime Live, and my guest today, Richard Hamblin. I'm going to turn it back over to you, sir, before the break interrupted you. You were describing the case that was brought against you.
Yeah, so we had the Heller case that was up there, and Hamblin versus the United States case, which was up there. And, of course, naturally, when you frame the debate in those two contrasting terms, they're going to take the lesser of the two evils. I personally think that the Heller case was a setup from the start. The result of Heller was to radically change the jurisprudence of the previous two centuries, and change the definition of a citizen's right to keep and bear arms from a objective one to a subjective one. Now, to explain this further, it'd probably be useful to go into, a little bit of history, and I'm going to give you some references and sources that I used, and starting from the very beginning, and then go forward and kind of weave it all together, and you'll see the whole philosophy of the Second Amendment, or interpreting the Second Amendment, has been turned on its head legally as well as everything else. Anyway, the place to start, of course, is, the Constitution, the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. This amendment was, of course, insisted upon by the Anti-Federalists. It was in the convention. It was, the Federalists who dominated, as Mike has pointed out, who dominated the convention, basically said, "We don't need no stinking Bill of Rights." There's no power, There's no power in the Constitution to prevent this. To authorize us to do this. So why should we put any kind of prohibitions against us doing it? Well, you're making up arguments out of thin air, Anti-Federalists, but actually the Anti-Federalists knew exactly what was going on, and that's why they insisted on this. Now, during my course of study, one of the best resources is a book called The Sword and the Sovereignties by Edwin S. Vieira, V-I-E-I-R-A, Jr., published in 2012. A lot of the audience may be aware of him. He published for a long time on News with Views, and I think on the archive in their website, you can still find a lot of his articles. And I'm pretty sure he's still alive. He's getting up there in years. But the last thing I think I've seen him write was about 2015. But he is he's a very learned man. He's got 4 degrees from Harvard, including PhDs and such, and he's trained as a lawyer, has practiced before the Supreme Court successfully, I might add, and is very much a legal scholar. And one of his other main works, excuse me, is called Pieces of Eight, and it is an examination in excruciating detail of the history of money throughout the United States. And it goes through all the permutations and the laws, changes, and going on the gold standard, off the gold standard, whether silver is money or gold's money, and all this kind of stuff throughout the history up till about the mid-90s, and with copious citations and direct quotations from the pertinent law cases and so on and so forth. So the man knows how to write, and he knows how to research very well. That's probably one of the best resources to get at, to study the constitutional right to keep and bear arms. He is the book's only available on CD. It used to be available on CD-ROM on Amazon. I've checked recently and noticed it's no longer there. He may have, if he's still active, he may have copies for sale. I don't think his address can be found on News with Views, but he opted to go to a CD-ROM because he could not get enough advance interest in the work, and it's about 1,200 pages from the audience to justify doing a bona fide printing, the expense, and to which he was sorely disappointed. I mean, it's kind of surprising, which kind of surprises me too. It just tells you that there's a lot of people that talk smack about the Second Amendment, but there's not really that many people that are really interested in getting into the nuts and bolts of it. Another good book.
Hey, bottom of the hour, folks. We'll be right back.
All right. Preacher man talking on the TV, putting down a rock and roll. Won't you make a send a donation? I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Real news, real talk, real people. Because you can handle the truth.
People often write to tell us what has happened for them since starting Extendivite. Allow me to read one. This product has been a godsend for my father, who suffered from a heart attack about 2 years ago. He was prescribed medications for his condition, which was so serious, he almost died. But he hasn't been able to afford most of the medications. After researching alternatives that were more affordable, he tried Extendivite. Since taking it, he has consistently lower blood pressure and experiences less angina. We are currently on our fifth bottle. I enthusiastically recommend this product, and I am grateful that it is available. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit extendivite.com. That's extendivite.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Find your inner rebel at Dixie Republic, the world's largest Confederate store, located in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. The anti-white, anti-Christ, anti-Southern world ends at the asphalt. Welcome to God's country. Log on to DixieRepublic.com to view our Southern merchandise, from flags to t-shirts to artwork. At the store, browse through our extensive collection of belt buckles and have a custom-made leather belt handcrafted in our Johnny Reb's Gun and Leather Shop. That's DixieRepublic.com, where you can meet all of your Southern needs.
Support those that support the network. Support Dixie Republic at DixieRepublic.com. Email ProudSouthern123@gmail.com and let them know that RBN sent you.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs? For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste for the price of a cup of coffee.
Hemppaste.com/RBN. Free shipping on orders over $50. See the banners for hemp paste at republicbroadcasting.org and visit hemppaste.com/RBN.
Welcome back, y'all. You're listening to Thought Crime Live on Republic Broadcasting Network. My guest, Richard Hamblin, is going over his trials with the Second Amendment. And I wanted to mention that there is a chat room if you guys would like to interact. It's TCLSDWChitango.com. It's TCLSDWChitango.com. You know, Thought Crime Live, Stephen Douglas Whitener, just the initials. So I wanted to mention that. I'd forgotten to mention the chat room earlier, sir. And let me toss it back to you with your case and where we are.
Okay. Like I say, there's a couple of primary resources I think are useful to understanding the Second Amendment. One's the Constitution, of course. Vieira's book is another. There is a book called, I think the title of it is A Documentary History of the Second Amendment, a fellow named Young, and that was printed back in the 90s, and it's basically a compilation of quotes from the what I call the constitutional period, when the period of the convention and such, and from various sources current at the time, talking about the adoption of the Second Amendment as part of the Bill of Rights. There's quotes from Eliot's debates on the state conventions. It's from notes, notes from the convention itself, and so on and so forth. It's very useful. It's a very thick book. I got a lot out of it. It really clarified my thoughts on what the intentions of the framers were. Another book is called Background to Selective Service. This was written in this was published in 1947, but it contains every known militia law of the colonial period, from the very birth of the country up to the adoption of the Constitution, I guess, the revolution of the Constitution. And invariably, the militia consisted of every able-bodied male between the ages of 16 and, say, 65 or 60, and they were required to muster periodically, and they had to provide their own armament, their own weapons of the type that were current among the military, which at that time was a long-barreled musket, usually 69 caliber or thereabouts, a bayonet, and sometimes a tomahawk, and they're supposed to have accoutrements like shot pouches and a certain amount of powder and lead and all this kind of stuff. And the goal being that when there are periodic musters, everybody had to show up. And if they failed to do their duty, they were fined. So back in the early days, you weren't taxed for having a firearm. You were taxed for not having one. And there were even provisions made for, indigent members of the colony and so on and so forth. But, so that was the background for the Second Amendment to a great extent. It was published in 1947 because what was going on in 47? It was the debates on the Selective Service Act of 1948. So the U.S. government was using this as a justification for being able to draft people into the military, which when you get down to it, is a violation of the 13th Amendment. because it's involuntary servitude. So, and in fact, as an aside, I think that's the only reason the Second Amendment has not been written out of the Constitution, because the government feels like it needs the legal fig leaf for the institution of a draft whenever they want it. So, anyway, in the Constitution itself, the militia is always called the militia of the several states. No such thing as a U.S. militia. They all belong to the state government. And they can be called into the service of the United States for three discrete purposes, and that's to repel invasions, suppress insurrections, and see that the laws are faithfully executed. But the militias always belong to the state. You know? The First and Second Militia Acts of the United States Congress in 1791 and 72, following Congress's mandate in regards to the militia, is to organize it, discipline it, and arm it. That's the three things you're supposed to do. And the First and Second Militia Acts, which were passed in, I believe, 1791 and 1792, give a pretty good picture as to what the original intent of the Second Amendment was. And those laws specified that the militia consists of everyone from 16 to 60, I believe. And then within 6 months of the enactment of the law, they were to muster and organize themselves according to the prescribed chart from the Congress, and to show up bearing arms supplied by themselves of the type and used by as common military weapons currently. This reappears in the Heller case to some extent, because the D.C. appellate court's opinion on Heller, which is actually pretty good, it was written by a judge named Silver, pointed out the early militia laws, and also pointed out, as does the Second Militia Act, that qualitative improvements in the weaponry are anticipated. In other words, as the weapon technology develops, the militia was supposed to reflect this. And he uses an analogy, says, just like, you know, today the Fourth Amendment covers things unheard of back in the colonial period, like, you know, computers and cell phones and electronic devices. So, Second Amendment covers increased technology and weapons. And this, in my opinion, is correct. Supreme Court didn't quite see it that way, but the circuit opinion was pretty good. Just kind of hit the high points of the main thing. The critical events, in my opinion, let me back up a little bit. You got to understand that all U.S. wars in the 19th century were militia wars. The War of 1812, the Mexican War, the war between the states. Lincoln, as you recall, pushed four states out of the Union when he made a call for 75,000 volunteers to suppress the rebellion or suppress the insurrection down south. So when you read the histories of the battles of this named Civil War, you hear about the Second Tennessee and the Third Kentucky, and all these regiments are listed by their state designations because that's how they were raised, and they were they belonged to the governor, to the state governors, and the federal government had to call up the militia. Congress had to do it. The president actually didn't have the authority to do it. Congress had the authority to call up the militia and swear them into the service of the United States. And only at that time did the president become commander-in-chief. He was only commander-in-chief of the militia when it was actually called into service of the United States. So throughout the 19th century, you had the militia as defined. In 1903, there was following the Spanish-American War, there was the passage of the Dick Act, named after the congressman that introduced it, and it basically created a constitutional fiction of an organized militia and an unorganized militia. And it put the vast number of people into the unorganized category, and the organized militia they term the National Guard, pretty much. That's where the National Guard was born. There were troops called National Guards in the latter part of the 19th century, but they formalized into law like that. So, and what this did in effect, which was something that the founders did not want, which was the creation of a select militia. They saw a militia consisting of the entire body of the people as a bulwark against tyranny. They'd had enough of standing armies with the British, and their oppression, which led to the revolution. It's one of the reasons why army appropriations are only good for 2 years, although they signed these multi-year weapons programs, but it's supposed to expire, has to be reauthorized every 2 years. Because they thought by control of the power of the purse over the military, they could rein it in somewhat. That's all been kind of washed away by the brainwashing and all this kind of stuff. So you had the creation in 1903, you had the creation basically of a select militia versus the militia of the United States, and the militia of the United States being a constitutional fiction anyway. It's nowhere mentioned in the Constitution, nor has the Constitution been amended to reflect that. So I'm thinking that they realize that a militia is unsuited for empire.
Yep.
Once they got off of the boundaries of the continental of the United States, there was a real reluctance from the people. In fact, even during the War of 1812, states up in the Northeast refused to lend their militia to a proposed invasion of Canada. And so, there was some jealousy between the states and the United States, which is as it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be a balance of power there. And the Bill of Rights and the first militia laws were designed to keep that balance of power intact. But then we get people, a tyrant like Lincoln, and he just basically does what he, acts without authority of Congress, because Congress wasn't in session, and basically started a war in 1861. Which has, tremendously dire consequences. All you got to do is listen to Mike's program. So we go up to the early part of the 20th century, and you've got the Dick Act and the creation of the National Guard. And then what's the next big event? World War One, of course, and the National Guard played a big role in that and so on. And then the first major legislative action affecting the right to keep and bear arms was the National Firearms Act of 1934. And it was adopted, popularly thought to be, in response to the Roaring Twenties, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, the movie Scarface, and so on, showing all the violent criminal activity of gangs who were using Thompsons and other automatic, Clyde Barrow, like that, he's a BAR. A short barrel BAR, which he stole from National Guard Armory. He didn't buy those on the open market. But prior to 1934 and the passage of this act, it was, it was perfectly legal for anybody to buy whatever weapon they wanted. And if you ever look at an old Bannerman catalog, which is a big military surplus dealer in the late 19th and through the middle of the 20th century, you can see all these kinds of weapons that were, including artillery pieces and such, that were advertised for sale by Bannerman. So there wasn't any real problem with it. And you can buy these things through the mail, And as far as I know, I don't think there were any age restrictions put on any of it. The first actual gun control law that I can think of, that I'm aware of, was probably the Sullivan Act in 1911 in New York City. And that was probably to deal with some of the, as a police measure to deal against what they saw as rising crime rates and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, the first action right there is, instead of making sure that everybody's armed, they're going to try to make sure that nobody's armed. So to get a weapon, and therefore that's supposed to magically reduce crime. I don't think that way.
The criminals are carrying anyway, it's like that. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, so you got the NFA in 1934, and it wasn't really tested. It wasn't really a test case until like 1938 in the United States versus Miller. And Miller is a very interesting case. There again, I think it was unusually argued And I believe it was kind of a setup for to get this law affirmed on a very narrow ground, and then Supreme Court refused to take any case, you know, approaching that until 2005 or six with Heller. And Heller was set up, I think, set up in a very similar manner. But anyway, the Miller case consisted of two individuals, Frank Layton and Jack Miller, who were, I mean, they were out and out gang members and members of criminal gangs and bootleggers and nefarious people. Miller was even a one-time informant for the police, so he wasn't afraid to snitch on his fellow criminals. And they were operating on the Arkansas-Oklahoma border, and the feds tried to get them, I think, on alcohol-related charges, and that didn't have enough evidence for that. But they were in possession of a short-barreled Stevens double-barrel shotgun, for which they had not paid the transfer tax. Now, bear in mind, when they established this law in 1934, they put a registration fee of $250 on the prohibited items, or the, you know, the restricted items listed in the category. Now, Stevens, the double-barrel shotgun back then probably sold for about $12.95. You know, so they're at the time, it was an extremely onerous tax to be placed on anything, you know, in relation to its value. And bear in mind that the NFA is a tax law. You know, the BATF started out under the Department of Treasury, and they knew they didn't have the authority to outright ban or even regulate these things, but they made up specious arguments, constitutional arguments, saying, well, we've got the right to regulate commerce, we have the taxation authority, and so therefore this is legal for us to do. Now, from a logical standpoint, and I realize that law does not really rely on logic, you look at the Commerce Clause and the Taxation Clause, they were passed as part of the Constitution in 1787. Okay, the Supremacy Clause, too, you know, 1787. Well, along comes the Bill of Rights, adopted in 1791.
And we'll okay, off. Folks, we'll be right back. Thanks.
Till the end in Carolina, I was raised by my granddaddy in my daddy's ways. They both taught me right from wrong, how to fight and how to get along. But my own life now is almost gone, in southern ground I belong.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects.
Email Tom at republicbroadcasting.org, T-O-M at republicbroadcasting.org.
Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Pouty Arco Super Tea helps build red corpuscles in the blood, which carry oxygen to our organs and cells. Our organs and cells need oxygen to regenerate themselves. The immune system needs oxygen to develop, and cancer dies in oxygen. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. The tea is also organic and naturally caffeine-free. A one-pound package of tea is $49.95, which includes shipping. To order, please visit drinksupertea.com. The first word is drink, spelled D-R-I-N-K, then the word super, then the word tea. The complete website is drinksupertea.com or call us at 818-965-9113, Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. California time. That's 818-965-9113, drinksupertea.com.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Hey! Yeah. Now, welcome back, y'all. You're listening to Thought Crime Live at... Thanks. I wanted to mention, if next hour, if you guys have a question, want to call just about the topic that we're on, take some questions from my guests, but please keep it on the topic. Let me toss it back to you, Richard.
Okay, thank you. So what I was saying before, chronologically speaking, you've got the authorizations that they're using, the granting of authority, that they claim for regulating firearms, were all passed in 1787. And, of course, the Second Amendment was passed in 1791. So it should supersede those provisions of the Constitution. Arguing that it doesn't is sort of like saying, well, the 13th Amendment doesn't really count because slavery is protected in the original Constitution. And another point I'd like to bring out is, a tax is an infringement on a right to keep, right to keep and bear arms, right to vote, or whatever. If you recall, in the early 1960s, the Congress passed a constitutional amendment, which was ratified by the states, barring the poll tax. So if a poll tax is an infringement on the right to keep right to vote, how could a firearms tax not be an infringement on the right to keep and bear arms? But, logic doesn't really doesn't seem to matter anymore in these things. But back to Miller. Okay, Miller was prosecuted for having a short barrel shotgun. As I understand it, and there's a site on RTKBA, right to keep and bear arms.org, called the Patrick Altice file, Altice, and it's called the Miller file, and it contains every document that he could find in the court record detailing the case against Jack Miller and Frank Layton. And as I understand it, the two initially pled guilty to the charge, because back in those days it was surrender the weapon, pay a fine, and you can leave, pretty much. Well, they tried to do that because to them it was no big deal. Cost of doing business, I guess, is the way you look at it. Sort of like, J.P. Morgan and the billion-dollar fines they pay for manipulating the precious metal market. So they thought they were done with it. Well, an attorney was found for them, a fellow named Gutensohn, G-U-T-E-N-S-O-H-N, were reindicted. The case was brought back before the court. A demurrer was entered, which is listed in the documents. Demurrer being an answer to the charge, saying that this was beyond the police power of the United States to enforce this. And number two, the Second Amendment protected the weapons. So The judge looked at it and entered a summary judgment, case dismissed. Okay. Remember this, there was no conviction in the United States versus Miller case. So the government didn't like that and they appealed it. Okay. It was the government appealing the dismissal of the charges. This is important to get to hell.
At top of the hour, you guys, we'll be right back with more.
Are you going to wait till the cows come home to get your new Ease-Off drop-in lift?
What in the world is an Ease-Off drop-in lift?
Our Ease-Off is a new tool to increase production for your meat processing company that will get that whole hog or half a beef on or off your rail with our remote control.
That sounds great, but can I afford it?
Sure, and the Ease-Off installs fast. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue, speed up your line, and increase profits.
Okay, I'm convinced. Where can I get my Ease-Off?
Go to easeoff.com. That's EAZEOFF.com. And hurry, because we're offering free shipping for a limited time. Easeoff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
Ease-Off, LLC, 417-932-6419.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.